On today's episode, strategies for overcoming all types of pain. Welcome to the podcast helping you train, rehab, and run smarter. When I first started running in my 20s, I knew it would be something I'd be passionate about for the rest of my life. But unfortunately, developing injury after injury disrupted my progress and left me undertrained at the start line on race day. Even with my knowledge as a physio, I still fell victim to the vicious injury cycle, and when searching for answers, struggled to decipher between common running myths and evidence-based guidance. That's what this podcast is here to help you with. So, join me as a Run Smarter scholar, and let's break the injury cycle by raising your running IQ and achieving running feats you never thought possible. Welcome back, Run Smarter Scholars. This is a bit of a habit. I have been earlier in the week recording another episode on the Overcoming PHT podcast, and I mentioned on that podcast that we've broken a record for the earliest time in the morning that I've been recording, and it was 5:45 a.m. as Mackenzie is approaching 9 months old. Her mornings, she's waking up at about 6:30 these days, and I have to squeeze things in. So waking up earlier, and so that was a record, and here we are again, Saturday morning, 5:45 in the morning, and recording an episode on the Run Smarter podcast. So hopefully this trend doesn't happen too long. I'm usually out this time of morning for my long run on a Saturday morning, but last weekend I scuffed my foot on some uneven surface as I wake up at 5:30 to go for a long run. It's quite dark and some parts of the street aren't illuminated that well, and so there was an uneven bit of pavement, and I tripped and I scun my hands, elbow, knee pretty badly, and they're still here. They're still existing on my body and still healing. It was quite a nasty one. So yeah, probably going to hold off this morning for a run. So let's record an episode. And I've got one lined up about all types of pain and understanding pain and tools and strategies you can have and implement yourself to really overcome pain. This was inspired by a podcast episode that I listened to on the Huberman Lab podcast. The title was, well, it was interviewing Sean McKee, who is the professor of anesthesiology and pain science and neurology at the Stanford University. And the title of that podcast was Tools to Reduce and Manage Pain. It was back in January 15th, 2024, if you want to go find that. It is 3 hours long, which I'm struggling to find time for my podcasts these days, because the more podcasts I listen to and the longer those episodes are, the harder it is to squeeze things in. But anyway, it was a fascinating conversation, and wanted to take away the main things that I found interesting about that conversation, as well as there's another episode that ties in really well with this one that I want to talk about at the end, which involves more about interventions and things you can do to manage pain. And one thing that struck me that was quite interesting, that you might find interesting in the very start of that episode, was Andrew Huberman asked Sean, you know, is pain something that's in our brain, in our body, or both? And he was clear with his answer. He said, it's clearly in the brain. And I've done a lot of pain episodes in the past. You may not have listened to them all, because I know there's a lot there, but we need to recognize that even if you have acute pain, chronic or acute pain, it's all stemming from the brain. Doesn't matter how severe it is, doesn't matter the type of injury, it is the brain that's producing those sensations. All that's happening on the skin or in the muscle or whatever damage you may see or perceive, they're only just what we call nociceptors from outside the brain and outside the spinal column. And these nociceptors are just like sensors, and they can only sense three things. They can sense heat, they can sense pressure, and they can sense they sense like changes in acidity or changes in pH. So when you do have pain, when I fell over and scun my skin on the ground last weekend, my body is recognizing pressure. It is recognizing maybe some heat from friction. It is not necessarily pH. pH would be like any like acid or you know, any chemicals that hit your body. But you know, my brain registers those sensors. I visually see my blood. I see the damage that's being done, and my brain's constantly evaluating, okay, how much damage is this? What's our scenario? What's our situation? How much pain should we produce? And the, you know, factor with that is I didn't feel a lot of pain. Yes, I'm not going to say I didn't feel any pain, but I wasn't in much threat. I continued the rest of my run, which was another 45 minutes, and didn't really have much pain. Yes, I was bleeding a little bit, but not dripping too much that disrupted me. But I wasn't in much threat. And so I calmed myself down, sort of assessed the situation, found I was okay. And then when I was running, didn't really have much discomfort. But it all comes to the brain. The brain's evaluating everything. It's the brain's job to interpret all the input that it has, input from those sensors on the skin, heat, pressure, and pH, as well as everything else. And it's that everything else that gets quite interesting. It also gathers, like, this everything else involves context, it involves fears, it involves trauma, that being trauma in the moment or past traumas that you might have, which I'm going to dive into. Catastrophization is a big, big one. I'm going to talk about that later. Anxieties, these are all personality traits and other characteristics and other pieces of data that's irrelevant to the damage that's actually being done. But the brain has no choice but to bring that in as pieces of data to then say, okay, how much pain do I need to produce? Later in that podcast, Sean, the guest, keeps talking about pain as being a sensory and emotional experience, and we have to treat it as a whole. So yes, it is, pain is a sensory experience, but it's also an emotional one, and we need to really factor that in. Most people think, oh, it's just sensory. Yes, I've torn a muscle, need to wait for that muscle to heal, and then I'm back to being pain-free. Not really. I wish it was that simple. And this is why when people talk about, oh, how long until I'm symptom-free? How long till I'm injury-free? How long till I'm back to running pain-free? I can say, well, if we're going off tissue healing times, yeah, we could tell you it's 4 to 6 weeks. If you have a grade one muscle tear, we're looking at 2 to 3 weeks. But unfortunately, pain isn't like that. Pain isn't that predictable because we're not just focusing on healing times. And we know very well that pain continues beyond tissue healing time. And it's only because of that, it's only because of the context, the fears, the traumas, the anxieties, that emotional experience, that's why pain does continue beyond the healing. Okay, I want to talk about a few things when it comes to chronic pain, because most of the time, most of this Huberman Lab podcast talked about chronic pain, and I know chronic pain is very, very tricky because it does persist. It does persist beyond healing times, and it's very hard to overcome. And they talk about three main intervention types that are very effective. They're very different in terms of how they work, and can be very effective. Good research to show that it does work. So if you have chronic pain, which is usually pain that persists beyond 3 to 6 months, you know, the brain's reorganized itself, the brain's sort of behaving and thinking differently, and the nervous system, the pain sensitization is a little bit heightened. Everyone's different. Everyone has a different pain experience, but I'm just sort of being a bit general when it comes to this. But if you have chronic pain and you're finding that there's a bit more of a relationship between your emotional state or stress or poor sleep and heightened pain, and vice versa, if you are in a better mood, if you're a bit more optimistic on that day and pain significantly settles, you know, the relationship to pain is more of an emotional one. These interventions for chronic pain seem to really help. The first one that they talked about was intentional distraction, and talking about distraction from the thing that causes the pain. And he says this really works. This could be things like books, going for a walk, going to social events, hanging out with friends, distracting yourself away from pain, and actively doing things away from pain can really help and significantly reduce pain. And he brought up the concept of, we know a lot of times pain is amplified at night when you're lying in bed because you don't have that distraction, and all you mainly do is fixate on the pain, and that pain sensation can ramp up because, like you say, there is no distraction. And I often talk to runners, injured runners, people with PHT, when I sort of pick up on parts of their story that leads to being like, okay, this is chronic and this is becoming a real issue. This is affecting their daily life. This is starting to really impact them emotionally. I like to just ask them the question, how often do you think about your pain? How is it, if you were to look at your 24-hour day, how often? And some will say, you know what, if I'm sitting for too long, yes, it's there and I start to wiggle and I start to think about it too much. But if I stand up and I'm in a meeting and there's something going on, like, I don't think about it too much. If I'm out for a run, you know, I might pay attention to it, like, for the first few minutes to see if that pain's there. But when I'm into rhythm, it goes away and I don't really think about it. I just take in the scenery and take in my breathing and my pace and it's fine. But I have other people that are like, my pain takes up every minute of my waking day. I'm either thinking about the pain or thinking or worrying about my pain in the future, or fixating on my injury in the past. And yeah, it's taking up every minute of my waking day. Those two things, those two scenarios are very, very different. And the brain's going to organize itself and prioritize things very differently in those two scenarios. And so if you are more of the, it's taking up every minute of my waking day, maybe this intentional distraction will be a very helpful intervention. So like I say, reading books, going for walks, doing things that you enjoy, that's going to, and also things that, you know, require your attention. You might go for a walk by yourself and say, okay, this is me trying to distract myself. But if you're by yourself, you're probably going to be thinking about the pain while you're walking anyway. So intentionally try to distract yourself. This tends to really work and really help dampen pain signals. So that was intervention number one of three. The second one was sort of meeting the pain, being mindful about the pain and sort of recognizing it's there, being mindful and accepting that the pain, accepting the pain from a non-judgmental, acceptable manner. And you are aware that the pain is there. You're recognizing it. You're not judging it. You're not labeling it. You just note its presence. And Sean talks about this type of mindfulness, and it's called MBSR, so mindfulness-based stress reduction. And I quickly just looked on Spotify and I saw a few audio tracks that you can listen to that have this mindfulness-based stress reduction. And it's just very helpful for anxiety, for stress, for pain. And as Sean mentioned, it's a good skill to learn. And it revolves around this, being mindful of accepting the pain in a non-judgmental way, just recognizing that it's there, because a lot of people have the pain and immediately attach a label to it, immediately attach emotion to it, and they say, oh my God, how long am I going to have this for? Is this going to be forever? Am I going to be changing up how I sit because I sit with pain this whole time? Am I ever going to be a runner again? Am I ever going to race again? Am I ever going to get back to doing what I love? Those sorts of things. These are thoughts that are deeply connected with emotion and deeply connected with your pain. You're sort of associating the two. This is sort of separating those out and saying, yes, I have pain. I know that it's there. It is a sensation. And I'm just noting its presence and sort of going through the skill and maybe having some guided meditation, guided tracks to listen to work on that skill. Just quickly chiming in here to let you scholars know, I have just updated my 5-day injury prevention challenge. This is one email per day for 5 days, learning new concepts and diving into the science on how you can reduce your risk of injury. The sign-up link is in the show notes, so fill in your details and I'll be waiting for you in email number one tomorrow.
It'll be really helpful. So the first one was intentional distraction. This one was meeting the pain. And the third one that they mentioned was cognitive reframing about the meaning of the pain, which is sort of similar. You can kind of tie 2 and 3 together, but this is just reinforcing to yourself that pain is just a sensation. And especially when it comes to chronic pain, it may be more severe, it may be more constant, it may be more alarming for you because, you know, it might become more widespread or start to have like burning or some changing in its sensations. But that's when we really need to recognize, because it is chronic in nature, your nervous system is more sensitive. And that's when we need to sort of tell ourselves, you know what, this pain, it's not really threatening. It's not harmful. I've gone beyond the healing times. A lot of the success stories I've had in the past have had this mantra of hurt does not equal harm. Hurt does not equal harm. And they tell themselves this mantra and we're cognitively reframing the meaning of the pain. So this is number 3. This is that third intervention they're talking about. Especially because we know with chronic pain, like there's no threat there. There's not a large amount of threat. It's just the brain that's really ramped up. It's not like you have a fractured bone or a torn muscle or swelling or inflammation or anything that's there that poses a real threat. You've gone beyond the tissue healing time. So we need to reinforce, reevaluate, remind ourselves, hurt does not equal harm. This is not threatening, and telling ourselves that. And that followed up with another question that Andrew asked is, how do we know? How do we know when it's harming us and when this hurt is harm and when it's not? And Sean was sort of talking about, okay, it all depends on what you believe, what the therapists have told you. These sort of things sort of create a bigger deal than it needs to be. So if you have PHT and you believe that sitting is causing more damage to the tendon and therapists have told you you need to avoid sitting and avoid stretching because it's going to cause more damage, that's going to really ramp things up. But if you start to recognize and get more education about the manner, you can start addressing the fears and anxieties, sort of allaying those fears and anxieties and calming things down and recognizing that, okay, this isn't harm. It does hurt, but it's not harm. So I guess finding the right therapist, finding the right type of education and sort of constantly reminding yourself of that can be helpful. They also said, does the activity worsen the tissue? So like, and also you could say, has pain gone beyond the tissue healing times? Like if someone's had pain for 6 months, we know that it's not ongoing damage. So then anything beyond that point, yes, hurt does not equal harm. I'm not saying go and run if you've had pain for 6 months for plantar fasciitis. We're not saying go run and it's going to be fine because hurt doesn't equal harm. It's not like that, because that's going to really ramp up the nervous system and potentially overload you in other ways. But when it comes to these meaningful sort of insignificant things like sitting or like, you know, walking and getting back into social life and sort of doing things that distract you, like social engagements, if there is a little bit of pain there and we know it's not that threatening, if you're just standing there and yes, recognize your limitations. They talk a lot about pacing because we don't want to, like I say, overload your body, but it's nice to get back into some activity and constantly remind yourself, okay, tissue healing times, things have healed. My body's just really sensitive at the moment. Let's remind ourselves that hurt doesn't equal harm. I'm very strong. I'm very capable. I've got a roadmap. I've got a plan. And just constantly see yourself in that position. There was another question about how to determine how much of my pain is physical pain, how much of my pain is psychological pain. And they mentioned, well, Sean mentions, I don't like to separate out the two. I don't like to say, okay, most of your pain is psychological. I don't like to say most of your pain is physical. He just likes to address the person and the experience as a whole, because like he said, pain is a sensory and emotional experience. So it ties well. And this is where he reminded us and delved into the literature a bit about catastrophization, catastrophizing. So catastrophizing is like an overreaction of predicting fear, predicting worsening outcomes, just a really, like I say, overreaction. An example would be if you have knee pain and, you know, there's a bit of pain going up and down stairs and you start to tell yourself, oh my God, is there a fracture there? Am I ever going to walk pain-free again? Oh my God, I'm going to be in a wheelchair in 12 months' time. Those sorts of things, catastrophizing. And he said, I quote, catastrophizing is one of the biggest predictors in amplification of pain, worsening pain, or poor treatment response. So I've done some episodes on catastrophizing with knee pain and the research around that, essentially saying if you take a group of people with patellofemoral pain, you give them a questionnaire that sort of ranks not necessarily how much pain they're in, but how much they are catastrophizing or have fear of movement. Despite how severe the pain is or how long they've had it for, all those type of metrics, the ones who rank highly in fear of movement and catastrophizing, they will have way worse outcomes than the ones who have less, who rank less on those questionnaires. So very important that we address this particular component. Sean also mentions that anger is a big predictor of amplifying pain, and also other things like fatigue and sleep. So if you do have anger, this is what I'm going to get into later on, you know, addressing that as well will help calm down the nervous system, will help reduce the amplification of pain, because a lot of times with chronic pain, it's just the nervous system is really wound up and there's just this real overreaction of pain signals coming from the brain, and catastrophizing and anger really ramp up those dials. And I've seen this too. I've seen the clients that I have, like I've almost seen like the opposite. Some of the clients that I see are just extremely optimistic, really happy-go-lucky people. And no matter, I can only think of maybe a handful that I'm like, wow, you are just buzzing with happiness for some reason. It's just their personality. You can just tell that they're this bright, and they come to me injured. Some of them have come to me post-operatively. So they've, you know, they're not just mild injuries, and they are just, you know, beaming, big smile the whole time. It's like, they give off a good vibe, and they just get so much better so quickly. And it makes so much sense when we talk about personality traits, when we talk about emotion, when we talk about catastrophizing and anger and all these sort of things that influence pain, influence recovery, and we need to accept that as part of the journey. They also mentioned nutrition when it comes to pain and recovery, and they said that the role is critical. This is critical, and we're learning more and more and more about nutrition and pain, recovery, those sorts of things. They didn't dive into many specifics, but they, Sean said, just good, healthy diets, anti-inflammatory diets can be really helpful with reducing that amplification of pain. He said that some people may have some foods that trigger pain. He drew to his own experience. He said it's an underappreciated area. He said that he had some part of his life where he got food poisoning, and that manifested as a lot of stomach pain, upper chest sort of pain, and then after certain types of foods would trigger that chest pain. And he sort of, as a bit of advice, if people are starting to notice those triggers, sort of identifying those triggers, keep a diary to try and find any patterns with food and their changes in pain, I guess. So that could be quite helpful. They talked about stress and pain, mainly talking about pain controls the or the brain controls the sympathetic and parasympathetic nervous system. So anytime there is stress, anytime the body is under stress, the brain will be responsible for dialing back or turning up the sympathetic nervous system, which is your really ramped up fight or flight, or the parasympathetic, which is your calm, rest and digest. And so when you are stressed, it can dial really things up a lot and can contribute to pain, contribute to amplification of pain, ongoing pain. And a lot of people have chronic stresses in their life, and that can manifest as pain and be really hard to facilitate that ongoing pain, unfortunately. And when it comes to strain, when it comes to stress, they mentioned early life events can sort of create a memory. Sean uses the example, he was in a car accident years ago and developed a lot of neck pain after that. And now when he is stressed after that car event, when other stressful events pop up, it manifests, his stress manifests as neck pain. And that can be back pain for you. It could be foot pain. And so it does hold a bit of a memory. Stress does hold a bit of a memory, and it can manifest as a certain type of pain sometimes. So you can see yourself in moments when you are stressed, what happens in your body, what happens to your injury, what happens to your pain, what happens to the nerve sensitization of it all. And there is research that they talked about that I haven't actually looked at specifically, but talking about what happens to us in early life really changes our nervous system, really changes our wiring. And they did mention some, a pain psychologist might be helpful in those circumstances to explore past events and past traumas and seeing how that might help. More about treatments. Sean talked about there's 6 broad categories to help people with chronic pain in terms of interventions to calm down pain. So the 6 that he mentioned were medications. Obviously, he said there's around about 200 pain medications that he can prescribe that help, you know, reduce the amount of pain. 2 would be nerve blocks and procedures. This is quite extreme, but if someone's had severe low back pain for 20 years, they might consider doing some nerve blocks or really minimally invasive procedures to take a specific nerve branch and block that. 3 was psychological and behavioral therapies. We've mentioned a few of them today, but it's mainly just addressing your emotions, addressing your past traumas and calming down the nervous system through those interventions. 4 was physical and occupational therapy approaches, rehab, strengthening, empowering, goal setting, restoring your body, essentially. 5 was what he called complementary alternative medicines. So talking about, he mentioned acupuncture and what he called nutraceuticals, which are just like supplements. So this is alternative medicines, He mentioned acupuncture can be effective for some, but they don't. They've done a lot of studies, and in fact, he's been a part of particular studies involving acupuncture, so he's directly involved. And he says, we still don't really understand what's going on, but if you can afford it, give it a try. Similar with some sort of supplements. I'm not too sure about that either because they didn't really dive into it, but you might come across a naturopath or some alternative medicine therapy that may recommend some supplements, and that can help de-escalate the pain for you. So number one was medications, two, nerve blocks, three, physical and behavioral therapies, four, physical and occupational therapy, five was his alternative medicine, and six is self-empowerment. Self-empowerment through education, skill development, learning more about your scenario, being proactive in your scenario, you know, lifting you up, empowering you. They did talk about manual therapy, and sort of where I position myself as well. Sean said, just ask yourself, is this really providing durable benefit? And this is when it comes to like massage and probably acupuncture as well. It's not necessarily manual therapy, but like anything that's just hands-on, foam rollers, that sort of stuff. Try it, give it a go. Ask yourself, is it really providing a benefit? And if it is, continue with it. If it's not, don't worry about it. But he also said attached to that is use this as an end road into more functional activity. So like I say, this is how I position manual therapy as well. Is it calming down your pain? Do you have a benefit? Not for minutes. I'm talking for days. Does it have a noticeable benefit for days? And then we can use that in conjunction with the longer term, more functional stuff to return you back to activity and things that are meaningful for you. Andrew asks the role of physical therapists and is it important? And Sean said it's absolutely critical, which I'm thankful for because being a physiotherapist or the US physical therapist is very similar, but glad that he has that viewpoint. He said that physical therapists can improve the quality of life and improve physical functioning. They can do goal setting with the patient. They can educate the patient about pacing themselves and knowing the difference between hurt and harm, knowing when's a green light, when's a red light, when's an amber light, and those sorts of things. But one thing that was very important that he mentioned was all these things that we do, they don't necessarily eliminate the pain. Not one thing that we do is going to eliminate the pain. What we are trying to do is chip away at each pain pathway one step at a time. So like those six interventions that I mentioned before, you know, maybe a couple of those just dampen the pain. And yes, chronic pain ebbs and flows. You're going to have some really bad days, some really good days, but hopefully in the long-term trend that starts to calm down. Bad days are a part of it. You're not going to try one thing for 3 days and say, this isn't working because I had one bad day. You're going to be patient and focus things on the long term. But a lot of these things, the cognitive and emotional addresses, the sleep and stress and anger and all those sorts of things, we're just chipping away, slowly chipping away because these pain pathways are really sensitive and there's a lot of pathways and we're just dialing each and every pathway back a little bit to help gain momentum. And so that's really important. So they're the key takeaways from that 3-hour long episode that I listened to. And I've just, what is it, about half an hour now that we're sort of condensed it into. But there was another episode prior to that that was a couple of months before, still on the Huberman Live podcast. And it was titled A Science-Supported Journaling Protocol to Improve Mental and Physical Health. It was released on the 20th of November, 2023, and talked about a specific journaling protocol that can help immensely for people, especially with chronic pain. This one was talking about psychological charged individuals, but like people with past traumas and that sort of stuff, but this really relates to chronic pain. So I thought I would attach this onto the back of this episode. this was just a solo episode with Huberman, and he mentioned that there are over 200 peer-reviewed studies focusing on this specific protocol and the benefits that it has. It's involving a certain type of journaling, and this is what you have to do. So he says, you need to put pen to paper and write about something you are, one, thinking about way too much, or worried about way too much, something you've been dreaming about at night, or something affecting your life in an unhealthy way. I'll say that again. Something you're thinking about or worried about too much, something that you've been dreaming about at night, or something that's affected your life in an unhealthy way. Chronic pain is going to fit well within that, or your particular injury. And then they have specific instructions. They say, I want you to write down your deepest emotions and thoughts. So this is when you have a piece of paper and pen. I want you to write down the deepest emotions and thoughts as they relate to the most upsetting experiences in your life. Really let go and explore your thoughts and feelings about it. As you write, you might tie this experience to your childhood, your relationship with your parents, your siblings, people you have loved or love now, or even your career or schooling. How is this experience now related to who you have now become? Who have you been in the past and who you would like to become? So we're talking about past trauma, really deeply upsetting, all the thoughts and emotions associated with it, how it might or might not tie into past experiences. How is this related to who you are now? How is this related to who you've been in the past and who you would like to become? I continue. Many people have not had truly traumatic experiences in their lives, but everyone has had major conflicts or stresses, and you can write about the most traumatic and stressful experience you've ever had. Okay, so they're the like verbal instructions. The studies vary in terms of how long you are doing this for, but it's anywhere between 15 and 30 minutes you are putting pen to paper and writing this down, and it can be confronting. Maybe, and they even mentioned giving yourself about 5 to 15 minutes afterwards to settle yourself back down before going back into everyday life, because it can be this raw emotion, really confronting, really distressing, and yeah, quite an emotional roller coaster. So maybe give yourself a bit of recovery time before then moving on. So anywhere between 15 and 30 minutes, and you need to write about that exact same thing 4 times on 4 consecutive days. So once a day over 4 consecutive days. That's the protocol. And Andrew says that we're harboring these stories that exist and are stored in our nervous system. How much does this relate to chronic pain? People are harboring stories about misdiagnoses or how they got injured in the first place, all the things that they did wrong, all the things that the medical team might have done wrong, all the scans that they've had, the misdiagnoses and the uncertainty of it all. So we are harboring a lot of these stories, and those stories do exist in our nervous system. It is short-term, but an intense protocol. So when he says short-term, like you do this 30 minutes, 4 days in a row, you don't need to do it thereafter. The benefits carry over and are documented for months, for years afterwards, after doing this particular protocol. He said that some people are low expressors, and some people are high expressors. There's these two camps, and it seems like throughout these 4 days, the low expressors, the ones that don't really write a lot of emotional stuff, they tend to ramp up a little bit more as the days go on. They get more expressive, they get more emotional throughout those 4 days, and that tends to help them. But the high expressors from day one, really emotional, really distraught, brings out a lot of distress and emotion over those 4 days, they tend to get less expressive. They tend to let more out, and that's both of those approaches are therapeutical for each of those different expressors. And like I say, this carries on years later, less distress after doing this protocol. So specifically, they said there's 3 things that you need to include within this 30 minutes of writing. One, you are encouraged to write the facts about the experience. So that traumatic experience, write the facts. Number two, write the emotions that were felt at the time and the emotions you are feeling now about the experience. So emotions that were felt at the time, emotions that you feel about that thing now, because definitely they could have changed. And three, you're writing any links that spring to mind about that negative experience and the negative things you are now going through, or what will, or all the links that might happen in the future. So how you're behaving with people, how you interact, how you think, how you behave, all of those things. Are there any links from that negative experience that now influence what you're doing today? Those are the three things that you should include about this in this protocol. Don't write it like someone else is going to read it. Write it like this is for you, because I would imagine myself doing the same thing. If I'm writing things down, I'm like, look, if someone's going to read this, I really need to pull back. I really need to be very careful about the words that I choose and how I'm phrasing things. You're not going to get the full benefit. You need to really, when things spring to mind, write it down. It can be as emotional. It can bring out a lot of things in you. It's meant to be quite confronting, and don't hold back. Who benefits? Because this isn't just about chronic pain in this podcast. It's in this episode. They're talking about it helps depressive symptoms. It helps anxiety. It helps insomnia. It helps people with arthritis, cancer treatments. It significantly improves symptoms. Fibromyalgia, which is a chronic pain condition. They also mentioned it reduces chronic pain. They say it doesn't cure these things, but it significantly shifts your pain experience and has really long-lasting effects on mood and behavior and how you go through the rest of your day, how you see life. And so you can easily see, like in that past episode, talking about the link with catastrophization, the link with anger, with decreased sleep, like addressing fears, anxieties, all those sorts of things. You can see how this particular journaling protocol can address these things that are so tied with chronic pain. Talking about the chronic stress and the sympathetic nervous system, what shifts are done there. And the one main mechanism of why this works, Andrew talks about, is neuroplasticity. The ability for the nervous system to change based on experiences, because the nervous system does change based on experiences. We know this. We used to think that the nervous system was this static, non-adaptive structure that's just there, but now we know that these neural connections, the nervous system changes with our experience. So journaling this way taps into the nervous system. You're modifying the nervous system and what happens around that traumatic event. And over time, with these 4 days, your truth, your narrative, how you're seeing this, the facts, your deep emotions, they're all brought to the surface, and it triggers this neuroplasticity and creates rewiring. It rewires these neural pathways. So this is where we're seeing those benefits. So revisiting 4 times sort of creates this counterintuitive shift where you sort of experience relief and a positive mental shift. People think it is a bit counterintuitive, because if you're re-experiencing such a traumatic event, if you're constantly being thrown back into those emotions, that it might actually be worse. Some people think that harboring and pushing down these emotions and forgetting about or trying to suppress these emotions might be the right approach, and bringing them out to the surface might make things worse. But we see the opposite. So this is why it's counterintuitive. People actually experience relief and positive mental shifts when doing this protocol. So think about it that way. I want you to really think about it that way, because sometimes by not talking about these traumas, you can almost create like a fractured representation of the event itself. And if you talk about the facts, if you talk about the emotions, if you talk about how you feel about it now, if you talk about how this links to your own behavior, you can start to connect some dots, and that fractured representation you might have about that event now becomes a little bit more realistic. It comes to the surface, and it can be modified, and think about it differently. So like I said, this protocol, 15 to 30 minutes, 4 days in a row, and you're writing about the most traumatic events that's happened in your life. You're encouraged to write the facts, the emotions, the links that you might find, even links that might be there, but you're not too sure, just write it all down. Things that you're worried about, things that you think about way too much, things that keep you up at night and what you dream about, things that are affecting you in an unhealthy way. Do this, and it will do this for 4 days. It's quite intense, and it will, as the research shows with hundreds of studies, it will provide a positive shift in your life for years and years to come. So that's what I have to share. I'm going to go have some breakfast now. It's this is just going to be added to the vast amount of chronic pain episodes that I've done. If you're not familiar with the Run Smarter podcast, the app, download the Run Smarter app, and in the podcast section is chapters. And I do have chronic pain. I have pain as a chapter in there. And if you're interested in listening to more about pain episodes, I've done about 15 of them. Have a listen. Go to that particular segment, go through those chapters, and start learning more about pain, because it is really, really tough. And I hope that this helped illuminate some of the things that you might be going through or thinking about, and can help your overall pain experience. So I will be putting this out on the Run Smarter podcast and the PHT podcast to help as many people as I can. Hope you found it helpful, and we'll catch you next time. If you are struggling to overcome an injury, you can jump on a free 20-minute injury chat with me, which you can book through my calendar in the show notes. While you're in the show notes, elevate your running IQ by jumping onto my free email list so you can receive material to help rehab your injury, lower your injury risk, and increase your performance. If emails aren't for you, consider my Facebook group, Instagram, and YouTube channels. And remember, each insight you get from these resources brings you one step closer to your next running breakthrough.